Chapter 11. The Things He Ate. This pregnancy was different. Our miscarriage had taught us some important lessons, and this time we had no intention of repeating our mistakes. Most important, we kept our news the most closely guarded secret since D-Day. Except for Jenny's doctors and nurses, no one, not even our parents, was brought into our confidence. In addition to the secrecy, we were simply more measured in our excitement, even when we were alone. We began sentences with conditional clauses, such as, "If everything works out." We didn't dare let our joy out of check, lest it turn and bite us. Jenny rose at dawn each morning and took Marley for a brisk walk along the water. My wife was the picture of robust health in all ways but one. She spent most days, all day long, on the verge of throwing up. But she wasn't complaining. She greeted each wave of nausea with what can only be described as gleeful acceptance, for it was a sign that the tiny experiment inside her was chugging along just fine. Indeed, it was. This time around, Essie took my videotape and recorded the first faint, grainy images of our baby. We could hear the heart beating, see its four tiny chambers pulsing. We could trace the outline of the head and count all four limbs. Dr. Sherman popped his head into the sonogram room to pronounce everything perfect, and then looked at Jenny and said in that booming voice of his, "What are you crying for, kid? You're supposed to be happy." Essie whacked him with her clipboard and scolded, "You go away and leave her alone." Then rolled her eyes at Jenny as if to say, "Men, they are so clueless." When it came to dealing with pregnant wives, clueless would describe me. I gave Jenny her space, sympathized with her in her nausea and pain. I even tried my best to indulge her increasingly bizarre and irrational behavior. I was soon on a first-name basis with the overnight clerk at the 24-hour market, as I stopped in at all hours for ice cream, or apples, or celery, or chewing gum in flavors I never knew existed. "Are you sure this is clove? She says it has to be clove." As the pregnancy progressed, so did Marley's training. I worked with him every day, and now I was able to entertain our friends by yelling, "Incoming!" and watching him crash to the floor, all four limbs splayed. He came consistently on command, unless there was something riveting his attention, such as another dog, cat, squirrel, butterfly, mailman, or floating weed seed. He sat consistently, unless he felt strongly like standing, and heeled reliably, unless there was something so tempting it was worth strangling himself over. See dogs, cats, squirrels, etc. He was coming along, but that's not to say he was mellowing into a calm, well-behaved dog. If I towered over him and barked stern orders, he would obey, sometimes even eagerly. But his default setting was stuck on eternal incorrigibility. Jenny and I had the foolish notion that it would be nice to have a dog we could trust to be alone in the house for short periods. Locking him in the bunker every time we stepped out was becoming tedious, and as Jenny said, "What's the point of having a dog if he can't greet you at the door when you get home?" We knew full well we didn't dare leave him in the house unaccompanied if there was any possibility of a rainstorm. Even with his doggy downers, he still proved himself capable of digging quite energetically for China. When the weather was clear, though, we didn't want to have to lock him in the garage every time we stepped out for a few minutes. We began leaving him briefly while we ran to the store or dropped by a neighbor's house. Sometimes he did just fine, and we would return to find the house unscathed. On these days, we would spot his black nose pushing through the mini-blinds as he stared out the living room window waiting for us. Other days, he didn't do quite so well, and we usually knew trouble awaited us before we even opened the door, because he was not at the window, but off hiding somewhere. In Jenny's 6 month of pregnancy, we returned after being away for less than an hour to find Marley under the bed. At his size, he really had to work to get under there, looking like he just murdered the mailman. Guilt radiated off him. The house seemed fine, but we knew he was hiding some dark secret, and we walked from room to room trying to ascertain just what he had done wrong. Then I noticed that the foam cover to one of the stereo speakers was missing. We looked everywhere for it. Gone without a trace. Marley just might have gotten away with it had I not found incontrovertible evidence of his guilt when I went on poop patrol the next morning. Remnants of the speaker cover surfaced for days. During our next outing, Marley surgically removed the woofer cone from the same speaker. The speaker wasn't knocked over or in any way amiss. The paper cone was simply gone, as if someone had sliced it out with a razor blade. Eventually, he got around to doing the same thing to the other speaker. Another time, we came home to find that our four-legged footstool was now three-legged, and there was no sign whatsoever, not a single splinter of the missing limb. For the most part, we were philosophical about the damage. In every dog owner's life, a few cherished family heirlooms must fall. Only once was I ready to slice them open to retrieve what was rightfully mine. For her birthday, I bought Jenny an 18-karat gold necklace, a delicate chain with a tiny clasp, and she immediately put it on. But a few hours later, she pressed her hand to her throat and screamed, "My necklace! It's gone!" The clasp must have given out or never been fully secured. "Don't panic," I told her. "We haven't left the house. It's got to be right here somewhere." We began scouring the house, room by room. As we searched, I gradually became aware that Marley was more rambunctious than usual. I straightened up and looked at him. He was squirming like a centipede. When he noticed I had him in my sights, he began evasive action. Oh no, I thought. The Marley Mambo. It could mean only one thing. "What's that?" Jenny asked, panic rising in her voice. "Hanging out of his mouth." It was thin and delicate and gold. "No sudden moves," she ordered, her voice dropping to a whisper. We both froze. "Okay, boy, it's all right," I coaxed, like a hostage negotiator. Instinctively, Jenny and I began to circle him from opposite directions, moving with glacial slowness. It was as if he were wired with high explosives, and one false move could set him off. "Easy, Marley," Jenny said in her calmest voice. "Easy now. Drop the necklace and nobody gets hurt." Marley eyed us suspiciously, his head darting back and forth between us. We had him cornered, but he knew he had something we wanted. "Drop it, Marley," I whispered, taking another small step forward. His whole body began to wag. I crept forward by degrees. Almost imperceptibly, Jenny closed in on his flank. We were within striking distance. We glanced at each other and knew, without speaking, what to do. We were less than 2 feet away from him. I nodded to Jenny and silently mouthed, "On three." But before we could make our move, he threw his head back and made a loud smacking sound. The tail end of the chain, which had been dangling out of his mouth, disappeared. We dove. I forced his jaws open and pushed my whole hand into his mouth and down his throat. I probed every flap and crevice and came up empty. "It's too late. He swallowed it." Jenny began slapping him on the back. "Cough it up, damn it!" But it was no use. The best she got out of him was a loud, satisfied burp. Marley may have won the battle, but we knew it was just a matter of time before we won the war. Nature's call was on our side. Sooner or later, what went in had to come out. As disgusting as the thought was, I knew if I poked through his excrement long enough, I would find it. Had it been, say, a silver chain or a gold-plated chain, something of any less value, my queasiness might have won out. But this chain was solid gold and had set me back a decent chunk of pay. Grossed out or not, I was going in. For 3 days, instead of tossing his piles over the fence, I carefully placed each on a wide board in the grass and poked it with a tree branch, while I sprayed with a garden hose, gradually washing the digested material away into the grass and leaving behind any foreign objects. I felt like a gold miner working a sluice and coming up with a treasure trove of swallowed junk, from shoelaces to guitar picks. But no necklace. Shouldn't it have come out by now? On the fourth day, I was about to give up when I spotted something odd. A small brown lump, about the size of a lima bean. It wasn't even close to being large enough to be the missing jewelry, yet clearly it did not belong there. As the water washed it clean, I got a glimmer of something exceptionally bright and shiny. Eureka! I had struck gold. The necklace was impossibly compressed, many times smaller than I would have guessed possible. It was as though some unknown alien power had sucked it into a mysterious dimension of space and time before spitting it out again, good as new. No, actually, better than new. Marley's stomach acids had done an amazing job. It was the most brilliant gold I had ever seen. Man, I said with a whistle, we should open a jewelry cleaning business. We can make a killing with the dowagers in Palm Beach, Jenny agreed, and went off to disinfect her recovered birthday present. She wore that gold chain for years, and every time I looked at it, I had the same vivid flashback to my brief and ultimately successful career in gold speculation.